WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. To most of us in the lower 48, growing up in Anchorage, Alaska is a pretty exotic idea in and of itself. My guest, Kim Rich, grew up in Anchorage, and her father was one of that city's most notorious underworld figures. For a long time, her father's FBI rap sheet was the only recorded family history she had. Her father was murdered in 1973. Kim was 15. Years after the investigation of his murder, she conducted her own investigation into her family history. She's written a memoir about growing up in Alaska's underworld called Johnny's Girl. Now she's a journalist and divides her time between Alaska and New York, where she's in the graduate creative writing program at Columbia University. She told me how her father made a living when she was growing up.
When my parents moved, well, before they moved to Alaska, my father, from the research I was able to dig up, was in California, moving between San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. And according to his rap sheet, he was picked up in just about every city as a burglary suspect, which, as I write in the book, back in those days, that was something they could, you know, pick someone up, charge him with that just to hold him for a few days. So it's not clear to me exactly what he was doing in those cities. My guess is he was probably gambling, running around in the gambling scenes. He might have been fencing stolen property. When he came to Alaska in 58, initially he sold cars for a while. He always had some legitimate enterprise on the side going, but mostly he gambled. He started running after our gambling houses. Then he took over a hotel called the Safari in the early 60s, ran it for a bail bondsman who owned it. And from what I understand, that was where the streetwalkers would go. It was in the heart of Anchorage's downtown sort of red light district. Then he continued to basically run after our gambling houses all the way up until the time of his death in the early 70s. And before his death, he was then running massage parlors, which were basic fronts for houses of prostitution.
He had one club that he called Le Pussycat, and his ads had the Tom Jones song,
right.
What's New Pussycat, in it.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. Would you describe that club?
Yeah, that was one of his legitimate enterprises. I think if my father could do things in the way he probably really wanted to do them, he would have been a music promoter. And he tried to do that for a while, and the nightclub was part of that aspiration. He loved popular music, and that was a club he took over when I was about 9. It was called the North Starlight Lounge. He named it the Le Pussycat. I don't know where he got the name, but it was a nice club as far as nightclubs in Anchorage go. It was a large, boxy building, but on the inside it had a stage and a big bar and a nice mural on one wall. And they used to have these groups that back then, these sort of small quasi-Las Vegas-style bands that would, you know, you had guys playing the instrument and then two or three women who would front for the band and would dance, you know, in these scantily clad costumes and would eventually take off all their clothes by the end of the set. And I remember I would go there when I was in fifth grade at the time. I would sometimes get to go there at night. And I loved it. It was a great place to be as a kid. It seemed all very exciting and glamorous to me. But I remember they would do songs like, you know, Ike and Tina Turner hits. And the women would come out. They would do, you know, Paul Revere and the Raiders songs. And the women would wear Indian headdresses and fringed bikini bottoms and that sort of thing. Or they would carry muskets sort of for some Minutemen, kind of the English invasion thing.
So what did you make of this as a young girl? You know, staying up late nights, being in your father's club, seeing gambling, seeing prostitutes, seeing showgirls.
Well, I had an, depending on what the enterprise was and at what point in my life I was being exposed to it, at different times it was, you know, going to the nightclub was very exciting. I could stay up late and there was colored lights and live music and it was very engaging. There were other times later when I was 13 and my father was running an after-hours gambling house in my home that it wasn't so great, because what it meant for me was that every morning at around 5 a.m., the downstairs of my house became a bar. And there was a lot of cigarette smoke and a lot of noise, and it would wake me up. And things like, I have natural curly hair, and I was wearing these giant hair rollers at the time to take the kinks out of my hair. And being 13, I was very vain, and I didn't dare go downstairs with rollers in my hair. So I'd get up in the morning, and I'd have to use the bathroom, and I'd have to run around my room trying to get the curlers out of my hair just to go downstairs to go to the bathroom. And that often meant standing in line with people just to get into my own bathroom. I didn't like it then.
Your mother was a bar girl and a prostitute during parts of her life. How old were you when you found that out?
The book began as a newspaper series for the Anchorage Daily News, and so when I began the research for them, for the series, I think that's when I first learned what exactly it was she'd been doing in the early 60s in Anchorage. You know, the book is really sort of broken down into thirds, and the first third is my life with my parents from birth until age six. And it was during those years she was a B-girl and an occasional prostitute. From what I understand, this wasn't the thing she did most often, but did perhaps occasionally. And as a child, I had no idea what it was she did. I just know that she went to work at night, and every night at around 8 or 9 o'clock, she would get dressed up in cocktail dresses and high heels and would go out, and we had live-in sitters who would stay with me. So I didn't really, again, have a sense of what it was she did then. When I learned later, it didn't strike me as anything so surprising or awful. In fact, there had always been this sort of secrecy surrounding my mother's life and even her death. And I, as much as I could understand that as a small child, I knew that she wasn't well, because later when she had her first collapse, her mental illness collapse, I knew something was wrong with her, but I didn't know what. I remember when I got her, when I was speaking with a clinic, a records person at this clinic where she had stayed, and they told me my mother had been schizophrenic and that she had worked as a prostitute. The two thoughts that went through my mind is, that's it? That's what everyone has been hiding all these years? They just didn't seem that awful to me.
But what exactly would you have to do as a B-girl or a bar girl?
Mostly they were high-priced cocktail waitresses. They would sit at a bar and encourage men to buy drinks and would get a commission for the drinks they sold. There's still some B-girl activity that goes on probably in every state. It's a thing that liquor commissions are still trying to chase down and eradicate. They also, from what I understand, you know, they would dance with the men. They would flirt with them. I wrote about in the book there were rooms in the back. They would sometimes take them to do, you know, heaven knows what, probably all kinds of things. Mostly they would just sit at the bar and get them to buy drinks. There's a picture in the book that a former B-girl friend of my mother's had and gave me. It's very striking to me because there's about, if I remember correctly, there's about a half dozen women sitting at the bar there, and they all look like your mother. They're all wearing, you know, high neckline sweaters and pearls. You know, they don't look like harlots, and they certainly don't look like streetwalkers.
It's funny you should say they all look like your mother. I mean, it was your mother.
Right, I know. They were sort of a cross between a cocktail waitress and a working girl. And it's not clear to me how many of them actually worked as prostitutes and how many just sold the drinks.
Your mother was institutionalized when you were young. When she got out of the hospital, she left her father. She bought two one-way tickets to Chicago and moved you to Ironwood, Michigan, her hometown. And you spent a couple of years there. Your mother was institutionalized again, so she wasn't home very much. And then, surprisingly, your father applied for custody. How much of a surprise was it for you when your father wanted to take you back with him to Alaska?
It was a relief at the time. Perhaps the hardest chapter in the book to write was the chapter on my years in Ironwood. In part because I have a lot of conflicted feelings about that, and it was a very painful period. In part because the people who I was living with at the time, my mother's family, are still living, and I wanted to bring some context to what I was going to say about them and about my years there. And in short, it's pretty simple to understand. I went from being with both my parents and living in a rather stable, if you will, home environment and loving environment to, at the age of six, being thrust into the world of strangers and relatives, and my mother having had her breakdown and my father living thousands of miles away. I was not happy about this as a six-year-old, seven-year-old, or eight-year-old, and perhaps no small child would be. I think that, you know, my mother's family, as I write about in the book, they did probably the best they could. When my father But I was very unhappy there. And when I finally learned that he had gotten custody of me, and it was just announced to me one day, I mean, I had no inkling that this was coming. I was thrilled to be leaving Ironwood. I didn't like it there. I wanted to be with him. And I couldn't, you know, I wanted to be with my mother, but I certainly couldn't be with her because she wasn't well. So I was very happy about that prospect.
So your father came and got you, took you back to Alaska with him. He was still involved in all these illegal activities. And he would leave you alone at night. You know, when the Tonight Show came on, he'd go to his club or whatever, and you'd be alone. Was that really frightening?
It was lonely, and it could be frightening. You know, small children have very active imaginations, and, you know, I being no different, you know, for me, the monsters under my bed seemed more real, perhaps, than they did for other children who had parents down the hall. But I got used to it. I never liked it, but I did get used to it. To this day, I tend to fall asleep with a television on. It's a very easy thing for me to do because I did that for so many years with him. That was my company. I had a dog. I don't feel comfortable unless I have a dog in the house at night. We always had a pet. And so the dog would become my companion and guardian. I never liked it, and I never quite got used to it.
Kim Rich is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Kim Rich is my guest. She's a writer who has a new memoir called Johnny's Girl, a daughter's memoir of growing up in Alaska's underworld. Your father was, in a way, a professional liar. I mean, you mm-hmm. know, he ran a lot of con games. He did a lot of illegal things. Was he straight with you?
Sometimes. There's a contradiction in the way my father... on the one hand, my father was... he didn't try to hide who he was to anyone. That's the thing that became abundantly clear to me in doing the book, and the thing that I'm most proud of him now, and even then had a sense. I mean, he was not a hypocrite, and he would often rail about hypocrites. And so I knew, I mean, he didn't like, when I was smaller, he didn't come out and explain, this is what father does for a living. I'm a professional gambler, and this is why I'm leaving the house at midnight. He never quite explained it to me, but certainly when I got older, he didn't try to hide it either.
Once you found out what it was your father did for a living, you begged him to stop. You begged him to stop gambling.
Right.
What was his reaction?
Well, I don't know. There was a period of time there when I was 14, a number of events were coming together. One was I was tired of living in the house with the gambling. Two, my father had a very violent temper. And up until my teens, he never really expressed it except in, you know, he'd have these fits. He'd throw things, he'd break things, he'd yell, he'd stomp around. When I became 14, or when I think I was 13, 14, he started hitting me. And it was a combination of that and the gambling in the house that I finally, I believe I got the idea from a junior high school counselor. I went to state authorities and asked to be taken out of the home. I don't remember an episode, for example, of standing around saying, I want this out of the house, and him saying no, but there must have been many of those because it didn't happen until I left the house and went to the state.
It must have been very difficult to initiate hearings against your own father.
Absolutely. It was very difficult. There was a problem, too, because essentially a lot of what he was doing was illegal. And right away, I think we went to one hearing, and we couldn't proceed until I had an attorney because they could not promise me that anything I would say would not be used against him. And that was very important to me. I did not want to be turning, I guess even then at the time, I didn't want to be turning against him in the same way that the police... and prosecutors had been, you know, were always after him. There were very specific things I wanted, and one of them, of course, was not that he be arrested and not that he be, you know, charged with any crimes as a result of his activities.
Did your father try to talk you out of testifying against him and try to talk you out of leaving him?
He tried to talk me out of leaving him. I don't know. Testifying against him didn't seem to be the issue so much as he just wanted me to come back home. You know, my father was, for the most part, a loner. And he was, as I write in the book, he was born an outsider and remained one his entire life. And I think clearly the only relationship that endured for him and that meant the most was his relationship with me. And I think I've talked to people who told me it was very devastating for him when I up and left the house. And so he very much wanted me to come back home. In fact, as a friend told me later, he ran into my father and he said, "John, where's Kim?" And he said, she left me. And so he very much wanted me back home to the point of agreeing to go to family counseling. This was not the kind of thing that my father would do. Certainly sitting around with a stranger, you know, and discussing his family problems was not something he felt comfortable doing, but was willing to do it in the hopes that it would get me back home.
Sounds like a divorce, doesn't it?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got out, you know, you became a ward of the state. You ended up living in foster homes. And while you were living in a foster home, your father was murdered.
Actually, I had come out of the foster home and was living back home with him at the time of his murder. But when I moved back in with him at that time, I saw less and less of him. He had started up running two massage parlors. And he spent a lot of time there. He was—he had to. He had, you know, from what I would hear him say, is he had to keep an eye on the cash register. He couldn't cash, you know, trust the girls. So I didn't see a lot of him the few months before his death, his abduction and then death.
Why was your father murdered? It's a long, complicated story. Maybe you can give us a kind of shorter version of it.
Sure. Let's see. Essentially, he was murdered because he had things that other people wanted. I mean, there's a couple different contexts to look at this. What was going on in Anchorage at the time is it was the year before they began construction on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It was going to make a lot of people rich. It was my father had set himself up in the massage parlor trade, anticipating that this would be a very lucrative business when some 70,000 men and women were used to build the pipeline over the 3 to 4 years that it took to build it. That's sort of the backdrop to what was going on. And he was looking at setting up massage parlors in Valdez, which is the southern terminus for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. His murder really was the result of he had gotten involved in a massage parlor that had previously belonged to another man who had been tried and acquitted in the murder of the previous owner. It gets a little complicated. But my father was brought in as a prosecution witness. He was subpoenaed to testify against a man named Wesley Ladd, who had owned the parlor my father owned prior to my father's taking it over. And I think that's where it all sort of began. Ladd wanted his parlor back. And furthermore, he felt that my father was richer and connected and all these things. Actually, he believed sort of the myth of my father as an underworld figure, that he was very rich, very connected, that he owned a great deal, when in fact he didn't own a great deal.
Was he connected?
No.
He was just a small time.
Right. And in a very small time underworld. He was a major figure in Anchorage's underworld, which was very small time compared to many other places.
When your father was murdered, did it make you think that the world was a lot less safe than you ever thought?
Absolutely. That's why I think I refused to have anything to do with any of, you know, there was a lot of people I walked away. Well, my father didn't have much of an estate, if you will, to begin with, but I certainly didn't want anything. And I took a few pieces of his jewelry, costume jewelry at that, and left. I felt that that everything he owned was stained with his blood and that the life he led to his death. It was very, I couldn't have articulated it for you at the time. I was 15, but it was very frightening, I think, and very confounding. And I had enough good sense to know that I wanted nothing to do with it, while at the same time there was all kinds of people around me, people who knew him. He was married at the time to a woman that he had married not long before his death and who I write about in the book was quite young, and I did not get along with her. But, you know, there was all these people running around trying to get a piece of what Johnny Rich owned, his cars, his jewelry, his parlors, his businesses. And I simply wanted nothing to do with any of it.
When your father was murdered, you really tried to sever ties with him, cut yourself off from him and his past. You didn't even go to the funeral. Your mother had died years before that. After a series of institutionalizations, she became very sick. I believe it was cancer.
Yeah.
And she died. Did you have the same reaction to her death?
Yeah. The thing is, my mother, I had not seen her for, I last saw her when I was 9 and she died when I was 14. She actually only died a year before my father. But in many ways, as I describe it to people, I lost her when I was 6. I mean, that's when she had her full collapse and never really recovered from it. And, I mean, in some ways, really the person that I knew who had been my mother for the first 6 years of my life no longer existed after that. And I think that in many ways, when she died, it was sort of, how can I describe this? It was anticlimactic. It was as if she had died many years earlier, because I hadn't seen her in many years, and she was not the same person I had known as a small child.
Do you ever see angles where you could take advantage of somebody having learned from what your father did? Is it ever a temptation to do that?
No. I'm just the opposite of him. I take the slow road. Uh-huh. I'm very leery and wary of any fast buck schemes, of anyone who thinks they're going to get rich in a hurry, anyone who wants to... I mean, I went to college. I got a 4-year degree. I'm in graduate school. I worked for 5.5, 6 years as a journalist before I worked on this book. You know, I have no desire to work in business or, you know, in Alaska, real estate's a big field. You can make a lot of money in it. I'm not interested in it. I think having grown up with, in that environment has... oddly enough, has created someone myself. I'm very stable in terms of my goals and what I want to do. So I guess it would only make sense when I used to jokingly say to people, and I say this only with very sardonically, but I used to grow up with 2 fears, that I'd end up like my mother, I'd end up like my father. And, I don't have those fears anymore, but I certainly think they guided me through a lot of my early adult years in terms of making deliberate choices that I felt kept me as far away from ending up, you know, as either of them did. Either as my mother, of course I wouldn't have ended up like my mother. I don't have, she suffered from a mental illness that I don't suffer from. But in the same sense, I always knew or always felt that I had to be very strong. I always felt that strength was something that I needed to have and to always display in order to avoid becoming sick as she did. Of course, now after having done the book and the research, I realized that strength had nothing to do with it. But nonetheless, that was still a guiding principle in my life. As for my father, I sort of felt like the way he lived led him to his death, and I didn't want to live like that by any stretch of the imagination.
Kim Rich. Kim Rich is the author of Johnny's Girl, a daughter's memoir of growing up in Alaska's underworld. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.